May the words of our mouths, the meditations in our hearts, be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our redeemer.
Amen.
Well, what shall I say? Well, what we better pray for, LSU has to face Alabama. And so the bad may get worse. So the people that go to the 8 o'clock service, normally when you have an 8 o'clock service, you all won. And we will reestablish the 8 o'clock service for sure. I'm doing a series on biblical words that are key to understanding our religion and our liturgy. And the word that we are working on is, right now, to start off, is the word love. Or in the Greek word in the New Testament, agape. And I started off by saying that thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind, with everything. And I tried to deal with that last time I was here. And today the easier part is thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And so we turn to that word love today in the sense of what does it mean to have a love relationship between two human beings. Now the word love is used in many, many different ways. We saw that people say, I just love Christmas Eve. Well, it's fun, it's not that, but that's because of what it does for me. And people all say, oh, well, I just love this or I love that. Again, it's usually what it means to me. And that's not the New Testament meaning of the word love, although it's a valid use of the word love. In the New Testament, in the four Gospels, in the Acts of the Apostles, which is the sort of the history of the early church, and of the many letters, most of which were written by Paul, the word love is the focus. It's the focus of what our religion is all about. And that will unfold as this series goes on. And in a way, all of that comes back to the person that the early Christians found something very special in the person of Jesus. And they saw his spirit, the spirit that they saw in Jesus at work in this little community of people who were devoted to Jesus. And somehow or another that spirit spilled over into the life of their St. Peter's by the lake. And we can see that love here expressed in the way we care for one another. Now, it's not a perfect. We don't do it perfectly, as we will see, beginning next week. The early church, all of these people were Jews at first. And they wanted to bring more disciples into their community and let something of the life of Jesus and what he stood for and that spirit that was in him, let it spill over to more and more and more, because the early Christians felt that was the future of Israel. That was the way the life of the community was supposed to be. And so they put focus on, in the writings particularly of the four Gospels, on the miracles that Jesus did, particularly the healing miracles. And you can see the quality of that love being given out from Jesus in those healing miracles. But I don't think in a way, you read some of the passages of the New Testament, and it seems as if we know this man is from God because nobody else can do these miracles. That's not accurate. There were other people who were healers in Jesus' time. And they laid hands on people, they prayed for people, and some of those people got better. So the fact that Jesus did some healing miracles is interesting, provocative, and it gets our attention. Particularly if you were the one that got some healing from that. But it is not that primarily. Most of us, as scholars of the New Testament would say, most of us would say that was not really the dynamite that brought these disciples to say, I will follow you. What was it? Well, in the Gospel of Mark, right off the bat, in the first chapter, Jesus establishes sort of a headquarters for his ministry in the little town of Capernaum. And that's where Peter lived. And he healed people, and he talked to them. But he also talked to them about the kingdom of love. And he talked till way late into the night. And he was disturbed in his sleep. How do I know that? Because scripture teaches us there in Mark that he got up way before daylight. And you normally don't do that unless you're having restless sleep. And what was going on in his mind? He went out and knelt down in the darkness and prayed to the Lord to give him the power. I want you to picture this now. Suppose you had brought a child of yours that was sick and he had healed him, and Jesus would have been giving the gift of that healing to the person. So in a way, the temptation was, I'll stay here. Certainly, if he asked Peter would say, hey, we got too much business right here. Don't leave. But he heard the word of the Lord in his heart saying, no, it's not just about getting healthy bodies. That's not the primary point of my message. What you need to do is go on to town after town after town so that they can somehow or another open their lives to receive the spirit of my love. So when he got the rest of them up and spent the night there, probably sleeping on the floor and so forth at Peter's house, and he told the 12, we're leaving. And they didn't understand that. And when they were walking away, you could see Jesus turning back and maybe hear someone else bringing a cripple or whatever, or a person who had an incurable disease sitting there. Why are you leaving me? I've got to go to the other towns now. That's the tough love. That's the hard choice. Then there is one verse that follows that's extremely interesting. As the crowd then walked away, they were heard to say, we have never seen it like this before. What was it that they meant? Was it simply the fact that some people got healed when Jesus prayed over them and laid hands on them? I don't think so. That was wonderful. They could say, praise God, that's an act of God coming through this beautiful man. But as I said, there were other healers in Jesus' day. There are other healers now. I have no doubt that Oral Roberts, and I don't really care for Oral Roberts in terms of his theology, but that be that as it may, God has worked through Oral Roberts far more than he's worked ever through me in terms of laying hands on someone and praying for them and their body got better. So yes, healing takes place through prayer. And that's why we need to keep on praying for people who have illness of body. I think what they said when they said we've never seen it like this is what they felt. He loves us in a way that we have never seen it that powerful before. Oh yes, a mother can hold a child and that child can feel love. That's fine. But somehow or another, the quality and the depth and the dimension of that love that Jesus had was far greater than any other thing that they could see. And they could tell stories. Now, the story that I have told you all so many times, and there are reasons why I tell this story, but I'm not going to go into detail with it now, but it's the healing of the lepers. And I've told you with a certain degree of shame that I'm not good with sick people. Oh, the Lord will let me do what I need to do. But Jesus was able to go to the leper, the dirty, stinking, lice-ridden leper who was kicked out of the synagogue, kicked out of the village, because he had sinned. And Jesus puts his hands on that dirty person and pulls them to his breast and says, in effect, I love you. Now that is even, and I somehow think when that happens, it restores a degree of dignity to that leper. And I think the leper could say, I don't care if I have leprosy. This man cares for me and gives the gift to me of his love by caring. I think that's what they never saw before to that degree. Oh yes, there's something of God's love in all of us. But they saw it in spades with this man. And that's why they could say, we will follow you. And so therefore, when the early community gets together and writes the stories about Jesus, the word love is all over the place. We think that 1 Corinthians 13 was originally a hymn in the early church. We're not positive of that. But that, you know, 1 Corinthians 13 is, you know, if I have this and I have that, well, let's put it into modern English. If I've got enough money to buy an island in the Bahamas, man, that's pretty good. It is nothing if I don't have love. And I'm a fairly scholarly person and studied a lot, and I've got a lot stuffed up here. But if I was offered to head the religion department at Columbia University or Harvard University, it's nothing if my life has not been touched by that kind of love that we saw in Jesus. That's important for us to examine. Where are our values? What do we think we really want out of life? And we've come to that with other words that we'll take up as weeks go by. And then the first lesson that she read this morning, where it says, God is love. And anybody that doesn't have love in their life has never known God. That's powerful. Because it says in there, for God is love. Wherever love is, the presence of the Spirit of God is working there. So this is what it's all about. Now what we've got to do is find out, well, if that's what it's all about, how are we going to define what this word agape means? What is it going to mean? Let's turn for a minute to the 20th century. Not the 21st century, the 20th century. I remember when I was in high school and I woke up that I didn't know very much and I really got a hunger for knowledge and I started reading. I think I got to be a senior in high school and I never read a whole book through. I'd much rather play. But I started reading. And I read magazines, I read everything I could read. Well, I picked up a magazine one time and I read an article. This was about 1940 and 1939. And it was a study that was done by a group of psychologists up in the New York area. And they had been studying this. This study had gone on for 10 years. And what was the study about? It said, we're talking about basic human needs. And at that time, they felt that the basic human needs were three: food, clothing, and shelter. But the result of 10 years of study, and here's what they studied. They studied children who were abandoned and taken to an orphan's home. Little bitty babies. Now, in the orphan's home, they made sure that those children had plenty of food, had clothing. Food, clothing, all of that. and shelter. They weren't left out in the rain. But something was wrong. And this disturbed them. And they watched these children over a 10-year period. And there was something that never came into their life. Many of them got sick and died of the group that they expected. And the ones who did survive okay, seemingly okay, there was something still missing in their life. And as they grew older, they still had a degree of disturbance that went on in their life. I had this vividly hit me when I did go up to Columbia to study after I went to seminary. And in order to support myself, I worked in a home as a chaplain. I was just newly ordained. And it was called Leakin Watts. And I lived, my wife, first wife, and I lived in this big two-story brick building with 100 teenage boys, all of them juvenile delinquents, all of them headed for bad stuff. But I'm not really talking about them. On the campus of this place, there were cottages that had children that were 5, 6, and 7 years old. And part of my duties was a couple of times a week in the afternoon, I would go over to those cottages and play ball with the children. And when I would throw the balls to them, lots of them, they wouldn't catch it. And I remember, and I wasn't too impressed by it at first, but there wasn't any enthusiasm in their life. You look into their eyes and all I saw was dullness, boredom, apathy. And when I left that, I went to New Orleans to be the assistant headmaster at an Episcopal school. These were affluent parents had their children there. There were parents that could spend their time with their children, and they did. And part of my duties was to go throw the ball with some kids that were 7 and 8 and 9 years old. And I did. And the difference was amazing. There was enthusiasm. They bubbled with excitement. Whereas those kids in New York were just filled with lethargy. They were dying. Even though they could breathe, there was no life in them worth talking about. Whereas in New Orleans, somehow or another, those children were very vibrant, very much alive. Well, what these psychologists thought in 1940, what now, went back to that article that I read about it, is that they said what the children in those orphans' homes are missing is something called, as if they invented it, love. You could say, why don't y'all read the New Testament? It's all about love in that. And y'all think you've just discovered it. But it was very true. And so we've got to now, they could say, what do those children need? What are the ones in the orphans' home that are 6 months old, a year old, 2 years, 4 years old, what are they missing? That they seem to be sicker than the other people are, more so. And why did some of them just die? Oh, they died of pneumonia, or they died of something like that. But why all this? Why the proportion of their life is just going downhill all the time? What were they missing? These people, these psychologists, said, birthing is like abandonment. And they would describe, here is a fetus in a woman's womb. It's her temperature is, 98 or something like that. They're in a water, they like fish, they can breathe. No, they don't get air like that, but they could live in a bag of water. And it was warm water. And then all of a sudden, that water, that bag breaks and the water goes out. And the environment in which they had survived is no longer there. And they vividly described And boy, did the Freudian psychoanalyst pick off all of this real much. And they said that being born is like being thrown away. Now, most of us do not remember being born. I don't. But here again, the psychoanalysts have gotten people almost getting out of their unconscious memories of this. And the word that keeps coming back all the time is abandonment. I'm being abandoned. And the psychiatrists have said over and over again that the first threatening experience to life is the fear of abandonment. And so, what does it mean to be loved, to receive love? It's to be treated after birth in a way that causes that individual to say, I'm not abandoned. I'm not going to be cast away. And I'm sure this happens to you too. But every once in a while we'll see in a newspaper, some woman has given birth and trashed the baby in a garbage disposal. Fulfilling the worst fear that that child could have. And these clinical psychologists had said that when you're born empty but hungry to be reassured that you are wanted and you will not be abandoned. And so therefore you have to do the experiences. This is the beginning of what now is commonplace. We talk about child development programs. I see school teacher over here. If you teach in the early grade, you're talking about child development all the time. And you go to seminars so you can learn about child development and what the needs of a child are. And this becomes what love is in the first instance. It's to discover that someone wants you and cares for you. And then, if you receive that love and get the reassurance that you are wanted, then as you grow older, your need has been fulfilled to some degree by your mother, by your teachers at school, by your camp counselors, by your friends. And if your cup gets full to some degree, then you have the ability to reach out to other people and give love. You cannot give love if you've never received it. That's a fundamental thing we need to understand about a life in the church. Unless you have received some degree of caring love and experience being wanted, you can't really love anybody else. And that's going to unfold on subsequent weeks. And then the next thing, as we grow older, and this isn't true particularly of a 2-year-old, but it's true of a 12-year-old, and that is the need somehow or another to be listened to, the need to be known. Now, this is the thing, this is a very frightening thing, because if I open up and let you know me, I'm not sure you would like me. I have often said in sermons like this, that if you knew my inside me, like I know me, you wouldn't like me. Because I am selfish, greedy, I love to get more than I want to give. And you would say, I don't want to be around you. But I can put on a facade. I can pretend that somehow or another I'm a real giving person. What do I want you to do on a Sunday morning after you listen to me talk? I want you to say, oh, isn't that wonderful? Oh, I guess I'm getting a little too old for that. I much don't care about that. I did, though, when I was 35 years old. I wanted to say, isn't he brilliant? But you see, that's getting, that in giving. There's a fear of letting someone go deep into your life. A fear that when they know, they will walk away from you. And here is one of the main things we have the need, now here's going to translate the word love. To be loved is to be accepted even in your worst parts of your personality. And that's hard to do. It's hard for people to get it. And so we kind of, we tell lies. Listen, let me tell you. Now some of y'all have done this. I had the privilege of, after my first wife's death, to fall in love with Lynn. And lovers, particularly grown lovers, you spend endless hours telling the story of your life. You know, I was 60 years old when I was dating Lynn. But she thinks till this day that I won World War II all by myself. I told her that I did. We're not going to tell the bad part about it, but we tell the good part about it, and we fudge a little bit. We want to make it good. To be loved is to open yourself to someone and be known. That's very important for us. I've told this story to you before. Bob Berry, a man in New Orleans, he was a highly successful businessman, made a lot of money, and he gave a lot of it away. He was a philanthropist. He headed all kind of drives in New Orleans to do good for the community. And he died of a heart attack, and he was about 65 years old, I guess. And out of the graveyard, when he put the casket down, and I said the last blessing over it, I went over to his wife, widow, and took her hand, and we got up, and the cemetery was just covered with hundreds of people. And she had a veil. People, women didn't wear veils much, but she had a veil on. And I said as we walked toward the limousine, "You must be very proud of your husband," meaning with all this accolade coming to him. She stopped and turned right square at me, pulled that veil up, there wasn't a tear in her eye. She said, "I never really knew him. He was so busy doing good things for the community that he never opened up the depth of anything to her." And that is sad. And that's not being loved and not letting anybody love him. So an important thing is not only to be wanted so that you can overcome the fear of abandonment, but to be accepted the way you are. And what they saw in Jesus was that he was able to accept the unacceptability in all of us. There is the meaning of the cross. And we'll come more to that later. But the cross, the power of the cross is that Jesus looks down on those who are killing him and spitting on him. And he says, "Though you kill me, I love you still." That's what agape is all about. In a way, this is what St. Paul says the purpose of marriage is, like a training program for the kingdom of God. We are learning the lessons in marriage and the family and a church community. We are learning the lessons of what it means to open up and move into someone's life, and when you run into the unacceptability there, to reach out and touch that person and say, "Though you are very imperfect, I love you still." Well, the problem is, we're born with a great need for love of the kind I'm talking about. But there's not enough of it. There's not enough of it around. And therefore, we are hungry. And then, why is there not enough of it? Well, there's a little snake in the garden. Do you recognize Genesis now? And there's a beautiful woman who walking through the cool of the evening in the garden. And her name is Eve. And Lynn, pay attention next week. It's all about sin.